Now I am relaxed, and I am in the deepest kind of sleep. When you feel that your mind is no longer concerned with anything, imagine a billow of fire to your right. Make the flames lively and brilliant. Then quietly say, I order my subconscious to show itself. I order it to open and reveal its magic secrets. Wait a bit and concentrate only on the fire. If an image appears, it will be a manifestation of your subconscious. Try to keep it alive. Keeping the fire always to your right, now begin to imagine another billow of fire to your left. When the flames are lively, say the following words quietly. May the power of the Lamb, which manifests itself in everything and everyone, manifest itself in everything, in everyone, manifest itself also in me when I invoke my messenger. Name of messenger will appear before me now. Talk with your messenger, who should appear between the two fires. Discuss your specific problems, ask for advice, and give him the necessary orders. When your conversation has ended, dismiss the messenger with the following words. I thank the Lamb for the miracle I have performed. May, name of messenger, return whenever he is invoked. And when he is far away, may he help me to carry on my work. Note: on the first invocation, or during the first invocations, depending on the ability of the person performing the ritual to concentrate, do not say the name of the messenger. Just say, he. If the ritual is well performed, the messenger should immediately reveal his name telepathically. If not, insist until you learn his name, and only then begin the conversation. The more the ritual is repeated, the stronger the presence of the messenger will be, and the more rapid his actions. I should not have put him down, Petrus said about the waiter after we had left. I mean, after all, he didn't spill that coffee on me, but on the world that he hated. He knows that there is a huge world out there that extends well beyond the borders of his imagination, and his participation in that world is limited to getting up early, going to the bakery, waiting on whoever comes by, and masturbating every night, dreaming about the women he will never get to know. It was the time of day when we usually stopped for our siesta, but Petrus had decided to keep walking. He said that it was a way of doing penance for his intolerance. And I, who had not done a thing, had to trudge along with him under the hot sun. I was thinking about the good fight, and the millions of souls who, right then, were scattered all over the planet, doing things they didn't want to do. The cruelty exercise, in spite of having made my thumb raw, was helping me. It had helped me to see how my mind could betray me, pushing me into situations I wanted no part of, and into feelings that were no help to me. Right then, I began to hope that Petrus was right, that a messenger really did exist and that I could talk to him about practical matters and ask him for help with my day-to-day problems. I was anxious for night to fall. Meanwhile, Petrus could not stop talking about the waiter. Finally, he wound up convincing himself that he had acted properly. Once again, he used a Christian argument to make his case. Christ forgave the adulterous woman, but cursed the grower who would not give him a fig. And I am not here either, just to be a nice guy. That was it. In his view, the matter was settled. Once again, the Bible had saved him. We reached Esteia at almost 9 o'clock at night. I took a bath and we went down to eat. The author of the first guide for the Jacobean route, Aymeric Picot, had described Esteia as a fertile place, with good bread and great wine, meat, and fish. Its river, the Ega, has good, fresh, clean water. I didn't drink the river water, but as far as the menu at our restaurant was concerned, Picot's assessment was still right, even after 8 centuries. It offered braised leg of lamb, artichoke hearts, and a Rioja wine from a very good year. We sat at the table for a long time, talking about inconsequential things and enjoying the wine. But finally Petrus said that it was a good time for me to have my first contact with my messenger. We went out to look around the city. Some alleys led directly to the river, as they do in Venice, and I decided to sit down in one of them. Petrus knew that from that point on it was I who'd conduct the ceremony, so he hung back. I looked at the river for a long time. Its water and its sound began to take me out of this world and to create a profound serenity in me. I closed my eyes and imagined the first billow of fire. It was not easy to imagine at first, but finally it appeared. I pronounced the ritual words, and another billow of fire appeared to my left. The space between the two billows, illuminated by the fires, was completely empty. I kept looking at that space for a while, trying not to think, so that the messenger would manifest himself. But instead of his appearing, various exotic scenes began to appear. The entrance to a pyramid, a woman dressed in pure gold, some black men dancing around a fire. The images came and went in rapid succession, and I let them flow uncontrolled. There also appeared some stretches of the road that I had traversed with Petrus, byways, restaurants, forests, until, with no warning, the ashen desert that I had seen that morning appeared between the two fires. And there, looking at me, was the friendly man with the traitorous look in his eyes. He laughed, and I smiled in my trance. He showed me a closed bag, then opened it and looked inside, but in such a way that I could not see into it. Then a name came to my mind. Astrain. This is not the real name. I began to envision the name and make it dance between the two fires, and the messenger gave a nod of approval. I had learned his name. It was time to end the exercise. I said the ritual words and extinguished the fires, first on the left and then on the right. I opened my eyes, and there was the river Ega in front of me. It was much less difficult than I had imagined, I said to Petrus, after I had told him about everything that had occurred between the two fires. This was your first contact, a meeting to establish mutual recognition and mutual friendship. Your conversations with the messenger will be productive if you invoke him every day and discuss your problems with him. But you have to know how to distinguish between what is real assistance and what is a trap. Keep your sword ready every time you meet with him. But I don't have my sword yet, I answered. Right, so he can't cause you much damage. But even so, don't make it easy for him. The ritual having ended, I left Petrus and went back to the hotel. In bed, I thought about the poor young waiter who'd served us lunch. I felt like going back there and teaching him the messenger ritual, telling him that he could change everything if he wanted to. But it was useless to try to save the world. I hadn't even been able to save myself yet. This description of my first experience with the messenger ritual is incomplete. Actually, Petrus explained the meaning of the visions, of the memories, and of the bag that Astrain showed me. But since each meeting with the messenger is different for every person, I do not want to insist on my own personal experience, as it might influence the experience of others.
Love. Talking with your messenger doesn't mean asking questions about the world of the spirits, Petrus said the next day. The messenger performs only one function for you. He helps you with regard to the material world. And he will give you this help only if you know exactly what it is that you want. We had stopped in a town to have something to drink. Petrus had ordered a beer, and I asked for a soft drink. My fingers made abstract designs in the water on the table, and I was worried. You told me that the messenger had manifested himself in the boy because he needed to tell me something. Something urgent, he confirmed. We talked some more about messengers, angels, and devils. It was difficult for me to accept such a practical application of the mysteries of the tradition. Petrus said that we are always seeking some kind of reward, but I reminded him that Jesus had said that the rich man would not enter into the kingdom of heaven. But Jesus rewarded the man who knew how to make his master more adept. People did not believe in Jesus just because he was an outstanding orator. He had to perform miracles and reward those who followed him.
"No one is going to blaspheme Jesus in my bar," said the owner, who had been listening to our conversation.
"No one is blaspheming Jesus," Petrus answered. "People speak poorly of Jesus when they commit the sin of taking his name in vain, like all of you did out there in the plaza." The owner hesitated for a moment, but then he answered,
"I had nothing to do with that. I was only a child at the time."
"The guilty ones are always the others," Petrus mumbled. The owner went into the kitchen, and I asked Petrus what he was talking about. 50 years ago, in this 20th century of ours, a gypsy was burned at the stake out there in the plaza. He was accused of sorcery and of blaspheming the sacred host. The case was lost amid the news of the Spanish Civil War, and no one remembers it today, except the people who live here.
How do you know about it, Petrus?
Because I have already walked the road to Santiago. We went on drinking there in the empty bar. The sun was hot, and it was our siesta time. A few minutes later, the owner reappeared, accompanied by the town priest.
"Who are you people?" asked the priest.
Petrus showed him the scallop shells sewn to his knapsack. For 1,200 years, pilgrims had passed along the road in front of the bar, and the tradition was that every pilgrim was respected and welcomed under any circumstance. The priest changed his tone.
"How can it be that pilgrims on the road to Santiago are speaking poorly of Jesus?" he asked, in a tone that was appropriate to a catechism.
"Nobody here was speaking poorly of Jesus. We were speaking poorly of the crimes committed in the name of Jesus, like the gypsy that was burned at the stake there in the square." The shells on Petrus's knapsack had also changed the owner's attitude. Now he addressed us with some respect.
"The curse of the gypsy is still with us today," he said,
and the priest looked at him reprovingly. Petrus wanted to know how. The priest said that these were stories told by the villagers and that the church did not approve of them, but the owner of the bar went on.
"Before the gypsy died, he said that the youngest child in the village was going to receive and incorporate his devils, and that when that child became old and died, the devils would pass on to another child, and so on for all the centuries to come. The soil here is the same as the soil in the other towns around here," said the priest. "When the other towns have a drought, we do too. When it rains and there's a good harvest, we fill our barns too. Nothing has happened here with us that has not happened in the neighboring towns too. This whole story is a fantasy."
"Nothing has happened because we isolated the curse," said the owner.
"Well then, let's see it," answered Petrus.
The priest laughed and said that that was no way to talk. The owner of the bar made the sign of the cross, but neither of them moved. Petrus got the check and insisted that someone take us to the person who had inherited the curse. The priest excused himself, saying that he had been interrupted at something important and had to get back to his church, and he left before anyone could say anything. The owner of the bar looked at Petrus fearfully.
"Not to worry," said my guide. "Just show us the house where the curse resides. We are going to try to rid the town of it."
The owner of the bar went out into the dusty street with us. The hot sun of the afternoon beat down everywhere. We walked to the outskirts of the town
and he pointed to a house set off by itself at the side of the road.
"We always send meals, clothing, everything they need," he apologized. "But not even the priest goes in there."
We said goodbye to him and walked toward the house. The owner of the bar waited there, perhaps thinking that we would pass it by. But Petrus went up to the house and knocked on the door, and when I looked around, the bar owner had disappeared. A woman of about 70 came to the door. At her side was an enormous black dog, wagging his tail and apparently happy to see company. The woman asked what we wanted. She said she was busy washing clothes and had left some pots on the fire. She did not seem surprised by our visit. I figured that many pilgrims, not knowing about the curse, must have knocked on the door seeking shelter. "We are pilgrims on the road to Compostela, and we need some hot water," Petrus said. "I knew that you would not refuse us." With a show of irritation, the woman opened the door. We went into a small room, clean but poorly furnished. There was a sofa with its stuffing coming out, a bureau, and a formica-topped table with two chairs. On the bureau was an image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, some saints, and a crucifix made of mirrors. Through one of the two doors in the room I could see the bedroom. The woman led Petrus through the other door into the kitchen.
"I have some water boiling," she said. "Let me get you a container, and you can both get going."
I was there in the living room, alone with the huge dog. He wagged his tail, docile and contented. The woman came back with an old can, filled it with water, and held it out to Petrus.
"There, go with God's blessing."
But Petrus did not move. He took a tea bag from his knapsack, put it in the can, and said that he would like to share the little he had with her in appreciation for her welcome. The woman, clearly upset now, brought two cups and sat down at the table with Petrus. I kept looking at the dog as I listened to their conversation.
"They told me in the village that there was a curse on this house," Petrus commented boldly.
The dog's eyes seemed to light up, as if he had understood what had been said. The old woman stood up immediately.
"That's a lie! It's an old superstition. Please finish your tea, because I have lots of things to do."
The dog sensed the woman's sudden mood change. He remained still but alert. But Petrus continued to do what he was doing. He slowly poured the tea into the cup, raised it to his lips, and put it down on the table without drinking a drop.
"That's really hot," he said. "I think I will wait until it cools off a bit."
The woman did not sit down again. She was visibly uncomfortable with us there and clearly regretted having opened the door. She noticed that I was staring fixedly at the dog and called him to her. The animal obeyed, but when he reached her side, he turned to look at me.
"This is why he did it, my friend," Petrus said, looking at me. "This is why your messenger appeared yesterday in the child."
Suddenly I realized that I was not just looking at the dog. As soon as I had come in, the animal had hypnotized me and had kept my eyes fastened on him. The dog was staring at me and making me do as he wanted. I began to feel weak, as if I would like to lie down and sleep on the torn couch. It was really hot outside, and I did not feel much like walking. The feelings all seemed strange to me, and I had the impression that I was falling into a trap. The dog continued to look fixedly at me, and the more he looked at me, the more tired I felt.
"Let's go," said Petrus, getting up and offering me the cup of tea.
"Drink a bit of tea, because the lady wants us to get going." I hesitated, but I took the cup, and the hot tea revived me. I wanted to say something, ask what the animal's name was, but I could not get my voice to work. Something inside me had been aroused. Something that Petrus had not taught me, but that nevertheless began to manifest itself. I felt an uncontrollable desire to say strange words, the meaning of which I didn't even know. I thought that Petrus had put something in the tea. Everything began to blur, and I heard only very faintly the woman repeat to Petrus that we had to leave. I was in a state of euphoria, and I decided to speak the strange words that were coming to my mind. All I could see in the room was the dog. When I began to say those strange words, the dog started to growl. He understood what I was saying. I became more excited and continued to speak, louder and louder. The dog rose and bared his teeth. He was no longer the docile animal I had seen on arrival, but something awful and threatening that could attack me at any moment. I knew that the words were protecting me, and I began to speak even louder, focusing all my energies on the dog. I felt that I had a different power within me, and that it could keep the animal from attacking me. From that point on, everything began to happen in slow motion. I saw the woman coming toward me shrieking and trying to push me out of the house. And I saw Petrus holding the woman back. The dog paid no attention at all to their struggle. Snarling and baring his teeth, he continued to stare at me. I was trying to understand the strange language I was speaking, but each time I stopped to think about it, my power would weaken and the dog would start coming toward me. He was growing stronger. I began to scream, giving up my attempt at understanding, and the woman began to scream too. The dog barked and threatened me, but so long as I continued speaking, I was safe. I heard raucous laughter, but I did not know if it was really occurring or if it was in my imagination. Suddenly a strong wind swept through the house, and the dog howled and leapt on me. I raised my arm to protect my face, shouted something, and waited to see what the impact would be. The dog had thrown himself upon me with all his strength, and I fell to the couch. For a few moments our eyes were locked on each other's. In the next second, he ran from the house. I began to cry hysterically. I thought of my family, my wife, and my friends. I experienced an enormous feeling of love and at the same time an absurd happiness, because all of a sudden I understood everything about the dog. Petrus took me by the arm and led me outside, as the woman pushed us both from behind. I looked around, and there was no sign of the dog. I hugged Petrus and continued to cry as we walked along in the sunlight. The next part of the journey is a blank. I only came to my senses later at a fountain, where Petrus was throwing water in my face and on the back of my neck. I asked for some to drink, and he said that if I drank anything then I would vomit. I was a little nauseated, but I felt good. An immense love for everything and everybody had invaded my being. I looked around me and sensed the trees along the edge of the road, the small fountain where we had stopped, the fresh breeze, and the birdsong from the forest. I was seeing the face of my angel as Petrus had told me I would. I asked how far we were from the woman's house, and he said we had been walking for about 15 minutes. "You probably want to know what happened," he said. Actually, that was not important to me at all. I was just happy about the feelings of love that permeated me. The dog, the woman, the owner of the bar, everything was a distant memory that seemed to have nothing to do with what I was feeling now. I told Petrus that I would like to go on walking because I was feeling so well. I got up and we returned to the road to Santiago. Throughout the rest of the afternoon I said almost nothing, delighting in the agreeable feeling that seemed to fill me. I still thought that perhaps Petrus had put something in the tea, but this was no longer important. We arrived at a hotel at 8 o'clock that night, and I was still in this state of beatitude, although it had diminished somewhat. The owner asked me for my passport so that I could register, and I gave it to him. "You're from Brazil?" "I've been there. I stayed at a hotel on Ipanema Beach." That absurd message brought me back to reality. There, along the Jacobean route, in a town that had been built centuries ago, was a hotel keeper who had been to Ipanema Beach. "I'm ready to talk," I told Petrus. "I have to know what happened today." The sense of beatitude had passed, reason took its place, and my fear of the unknown, along with an urgent need to get my feet back on the ground, had returned. "After we eat," said Petrus. Petrus asked the hotel owner to turn on the television, but to leave the sound off. He said that this was the best way for me to hear everything he said without asking a lot of questions, because part of me would be watching the television screen. He asked me how much I remembered of what had happened. I answered that I remembered everything except the part where we had walked to the fountain. "That part is not important to the story," he answered. On the television screen, a film having something to do with coal mines began. The actors were dressed in turn-of-the-century clothing. "Yesterday, when I sensed the urgency in your messenger, I knew that a battle along the road to Santiago was about to begin. You are here to find your sword and learn the ram practices. But every time a guide leads a pilgrim, there is at least one situation that goes beyond the control of both of them. It represents a kind of practical test of what is being taught. In your case, this was the encounter with the dog. The details of the battle and the explanation for the many devils that can be present in an animal I will explain later. What is important now is that you understand that the woman was already used to the curse. She had accepted it as normal, and the attitudes of the world were fine with her. She had learned to be satisfied with very little. When you exorcised the poor old woman's demons, you also unbalanced her universe. The other day we talked about the cruelty that people are capable of inflicting on themselves. Often when we try to demonstrate that life is good and generous, such people reject the idea as if it came from the devil. People don't like to ask too much of life because they're afraid they will be defeated. But if someone wants to fight the good fight, that person must view the world as if it were a marvelous treasure, waiting to be discovered and won. Petrus asked me if I knew what I was doing there on the road to Santiago. "I am searching for my sword," I answered. "And what do you want your sword for?" "I want it because it will bring me the power and the wisdom of the tradition." I felt that he was not too happy with my response, but he continued, "You are here, searching for a reward. You are daring to dream, and you are doing everything possible to make your dream come true. You need to have a better idea of what it is that you are going to do with your sword. This has to be clearer to you before we can find it. But there is one thing in your favor. You are looking for a reward. You are walking the road to Santiago only because you want to be rewarded for your effort. I have noticed that you have applied everything I have taught you. You have been looking for a practical outcome. That is very positive. The only thing missing is your learning how to combine the ram practices with your own intuition. The language of your heart is going to determine the best way to find and use your sword. If you can bring the two together, the exercises and the ram practices will become simply a part of the useless wisdom of the tradition. Petrus had told me this before, in a different way, and although I agreed with him, it wasn't what I wanted to hear about. There were two aspects of the experience that I could not understand. The strange language I had spoken, and my feeling of love and happiness after having evicted the dog. The sensation of happiness occurred because your action was suffused with agape. "You talk a lot about agape, but you haven't really explained to me what it is. I have a feeling we are dealing with something that relates to a higher form of love." "That's exactly right. In a little while, the time will come for you to experience that intense love, the love that consumes the one who loves. Meanwhile, be happy knowing that this love has manifested itself freely in you." I've had this sensation before, but it was brief, and it was different somehow. It always happened after a professional triumph, a win, or when I felt that Lady Luck was being generous with me. But when the feeling arose, I always pulled back. I felt frightened of experiencing it too intensely, as if the happiness could cause envy in others, or as if I were unworthy of it. All of us, before we learn about agape, act that way, he said with his gaze on the television screen. I asked him about the strange language I had spoken. That was a surprise to me. That is not a practice of the road to Santiago. It is a divine grace, and it is one of the Ram practices for the road to Rome. I had already heard some things about the divine graces, but I asked Petrus to explain them to me. They're gifts from the Holy Ghost that manifest themselves in people. There are a number of different kinds, the gift of curing, the gift of miracles, the gift of prophecy, among others. You experienced the gift of tongues, which is what the apostles experienced at Pentecost. The gift of tongues is related to direct communication with the Holy Ghost. It is used in powerful oratory, in exorcisms, as was your case, and in wisdom. Your days on the road and the ram practices not only led to the danger that the dog represented for you, but also by chance gave rise to the gift of tongues. It won't happen again unless you find your sword and decide to walk the road to Rome. In any case, it was a good omen. I watched the silent television screen. The story of the coal mines had been transformed into a succession of men and women talking and arguing. Every so often an actor and an actress would kiss. "One other thing," said Petrus. "It may be that you are going to meet up with that dog again. Next time, don't try to invoke the gift of tongues, because it won't come back. Trust in what your intuition is going to tell you. I am going to teach you another ram practice that will enhance your intuition. With it, you will begin to learn the secret language of your mind, and that language will be very useful to you for the rest of your life." Petrus turned the television off, just as I was beginning to get involved in the story. He went to the bar and asked for a bottle of mineral water. We each drank a little, and he took what was left outdoors. We felt the fresh air, and for a few moments neither of us said anything. The night was quiet, and the Milky Way overhead reminded me again that my goal was to find my sword. After some time, Petrus taught me the water exercise. "I'm tired. I'm going to bed," he said. "But do this exercise now. Call up your intuition again, your secret side. Don't be concerned about logic, because water is a fluid element, and it does not allow itself to be controlled easily. But water, little by little and in a non-violent way, is going to build a new relationship between you and your universe." And before he went through the door of the hotel, he added, "It is not often that someone gets help from a dog." I continued to enjoy the freshness and the silence of the night. The hotel was out in the country, and there was no one there with me. I remembered the owner who had been to Ipanema. He must find it absurd to see me there in that arid place, burned by the sun that shone down with such ferocity, day after day. The arousal of intuition, the water exercise. Make a puddle of water on a smooth, non-absorbent surface. Look into the puddle for a while, then begin to play with it, without any particular commitment or objective. Make designs that mean absolutely nothing. Do this exercise for a week, allowing at least 10 minutes each time. Don't look for practical results from this exercise. It is simply calling up your intuition, little by little. When this intuition begins to manifest itself at other times of the day, always trust in it. I was getting sleepy, so I decided to do the exercise right away. I emptied the remaining water under the cement, and a small puddle formed. I did not have any image or shape in mind, and I wasn't seeking one. I swirled my fingers through the cold water, and I experienced the same kind of hypnosis that one feels when staring into the flames of a fire. I thought about nothing. I was just playing with a puddle of water. I made some streaks at the edge of the puddle, and it seemed to become a wet sun, but the streaks quickly rejoined the puddle and disappeared, With the palm of my hand, I batted at the center of the puddle. The water splashed away, covering the cement with droplets, black stars on a gray background. I was completely lost in that absurd exercise, an exercise that had not the slightest purpose but was delightful to do. I felt that my mind had stopped working almost completely, a feeling I had previously achieved only after long periods of meditation and relaxation. At the same time, something told me that down deep, in places that my mind could not reach, a force was being born and becoming ready to manifest itself. I stayed there for quite a while playing with the puddle, and it was difficult to give up the exercise. If Petrus had taught me the water exercise at the beginning of the journey, there is no doubt that I would have found it to be a waste of time. But now, having spoken in strange tongues and having exercised devils, that puddle of water established a contact, however fragile, with the Milky Way above me. It reflected the stars, created designs I could not understand, and gave me the feeling not that I was wasting time, but that I was creating a new code for communicating with the world. It was the soul's secret code, a language that we know but so seldom hear. When I came back to myself, it was late. The lights at the door had been turned off, and I entered the hotel quietly. In my room, once again, I invoked Astrain. He appeared more clearly, and I spoke to him for a while about my sword and about my goals in life. For now he made no answer, but Petrus had told me that as the invocations continued, Astrain would become a live and powerful presence at my side. Marriage. Logroño is one of the largest cities through which pilgrims traveling the Jacobean route pass. The only other city of any size that we had entered had been Pamplona, but we had not spent the night there. On the afternoon that we arrived in Logroño, though, the city was preparing for a great festival, and Petrus suggested that we stay there, at least for one night. I was used to the silence and freedom of the countryside, so the idea did not much appeal to me. It had been 5 days since the incident with the dog, and every night since I had invoked Astrain and performed the water exercise. I was feeling very calm, and I was more and more aware of the importance of the road to Santiago in my life, and of the question of what I was going to do after the pilgrimage had ended. The area we walked through was like a desert. The meals were seldom very good, and the long days on the road were exhausting. But I was living my dream. All of these feelings disappeared the day we arrived at Logroño. Instead of the warm, pure air of the fields, we found a city crowded with cars, journalists, and television equipment. Petrus went into the first bar we saw to ask what was happening.
"You don't know? Today is the wedding of Colonel M's daughter," said the bartender. "We're going to have a huge public banquet in the square, and I am closing early today."
It was impossible to find rooms at a hotel, but eventually we were given lodging at the home of an elderly couple who had noticed the shells on Petrus's knapsack. We showered, I put on the only trousers that I had brought, and we left for the town square. Dozens of workers, perspiring in their black suits, were putting the finishing touches on the tables that had been placed all over the square. National television crews were filming the preparations. We went down a narrow street that led to the church of the Royal Santiago Parish, where the ceremony was about to begin. Flocking to the church were great numbers of well-dressed people. The women's makeup was running in the heat, and their children, dressed in white, were irritable. Some fireworks were exploding overhead as a long black limousine stopped at the main gate. It was the groom arriving. There was no room for Petrus and me in the church, so we decided to go back to the square. Petrus wanted to scout around, but I sat down on one of the benches, waiting for the ceremony to end and the banquet to begin. Nearby, a popcorn vendor, hoping for a windfall profit, awaited the crowd from the church.
"Are you one of the invited guests?" he asked me.
"No," I answered. "We are pilgrims on our way to Compostela."
There's a train that goes there straight from Madrid, and if you leave on a Friday, you get your hotel free.
Yes, but we are doing a pilgrimage. The vendor looked at me and said respectfully,
"Pilgrimages are made by saints."
I decided not to get into that discussion. He said that his daughter had already been married, but was now separated from her husband.
"In Franco's time, there was more respect," he said. "Nowadays, no one cares about the family."
Despite my being in a strange country, where it is never advisable to talk politics, I could not let this pass without a response. I said that Franco had been a dictator and that nothing during his time could have been better than now. The vendor's face turned red.
"Who do you think you are, talking like that?"
"I know this country's history. I know the war the people fought for their freedom. I've read about the crimes of the Franco forces during the Spanish Civil War.
Well, I fought in that war. I was there when my family's blood was spilled. Whatever stories you have read don't interest me. What I'm concerned about is what happens to my family. I fought against Franco, but when he won the war, life was better for me. I am not a beggar, and I have my little popcorn stand. It wasn't this socialist government we have now that helped me. I'm worse off now than I was before."
I remembered what Petrus had said about people being content with very little. I decided not to press my point of view, and I moved to another bench. When Petrus came back, I told him about my exchange with the popcorn vendor.
"Conversation is useful," he said, "when people want to convince themselves that what they are saying is right. I am a member of the Italian Communist Party, but I didn't know about this fascist side of you."
"What do you mean, fascist side?" I asked him angrily.
"Well, you helped the popcorn man to convince himself that Franco was good. Maybe he never knew why. Now he knows."
"Well, I'm just as surprised to learn that the ICP believes in the gifts of the Holy Ghost."
"Well, I have to be careful about what the neighbors will think," he said, laughing.
The fireworks started up again, as the musicians climbed to the bandstand and tuned their instruments. The festival was about to begin. I looked up at the sky. It was growing dark, and the stars were beginning to appear. Petrus went over to one of the waiters and brought back two plastic cups full of wine.
"It is good luck to have a drink before the party begins," he said, handing me one of the cups. "Have some of this. It will help you forget about the popcorn man."
I wasn't even thinking about him anymore.
"Well, you should, because what happened with him is an example of mistaken behavior. We are always trying to convert people to a belief in our own explanation of the universe. We think that the more people there are who believe as we do, the more certain it will be that what we believe is the truth. But it doesn't work that way at all. Look around. Here is a huge party about to begin. A commemoration. Many different things are being celebrated simultaneously. The father's hope that his daughter would marry, the daughter's wish for the same thing, the groom's dreams. That's good, because they believe in their dreams and want to demonstrate to everyone that they have achieved their goals. It is not a party that is being held to convince anyone of anything, so it's going to be a lot of fun. From what I can see, they are people who have fought the good fight of love."
"But you were trying to convince me, Petrus, by guiding me along the road to Santiago." He gave me a cold look.
"I am only teaching you the ram practices. But you will find your sword only if you discover that the road and the truth and the life are in your heart."
Petrus pointed to the sky, where the stars were now clearly visible. "There is no religion that is capable of bringing all the stars together, because if this were to happen, the universe would become a gigantic empty space and would lose its reason for existence. Every star and every person has their own space and their own special characteristics. There are green stars, yellow stars, blue stars, and white stars.
and there are comets, meteors, and meteorites, nebulas, and rings. What appear from down here to be a huge number of bodies that are similar to each other are really a million different things, spread over a space that is beyond human comprehension. A rocket from the fireworks burst, and its light obscured the sky for a moment. A shower of brilliant green streamers fell to the ground. Earlier, we only heard their noise because of the daylight. Now we can see their light, Petrus said. That's the only change people can aspire to. The bride came out of the church, and people shouted and threw their handfuls of rice. She was a thin girl of about 16, and she held the arm of a boy in a tuxedo. The congregation appeared and began to move toward the square.
"Look, there's the colonel. Oh, look at the bride's dress, how beautiful," said some boys near us.
The guests took their places at the tables, the waiters served the wine, and the band began to play. The popcorn vendor was surrounded by a mob of screaming boys who made their purchases and then scattered the empty bags on the ground. I imagined that for the townspeople of Logroño, at least that night, the rest of the world, with its threat of nuclear war, unemployment, and murders, did not exist. It was a festival night. The tables had been placed in the square for the people, and everyone felt important. A television crew came toward us, and Petrus averted his face. But the men passed us by, heading for one of the guests who sat near us. I recognized immediately who he was. Antonio, the man who had led the Spanish fans in their cheers at the World Cup in Mexico in 1986. When the interview was over, I went up to him and told him that I was a Brazilian, feigning anger, and he complained about a goal of which Spain had been robbed in the opening round of the Cup. In the game between Spain and Brazil at that World Cup in Mexico, a Spanish goal was nullified because the referee had not seen the ball hit behind the goal line before ricocheting out. Brazil wound up winning that game 1-0. But then he gave me a hug and said that Brazil would soon once again have the best players in the world. "How do you manage to see the game when your back is always to the field and you're inciting the fans?" I asked. It was something I had noticed over and over again during the television transmissions of the World Cup games. "That's what gives me satisfaction, helping the fans believe in the victory." And then, as if he too were a guide on the road to Santiago, he said, "Fans who lack the faith can make a team lose a game it is already winning." Antonio was then grabbed by others who wanted to interview him, but I stood there thinking about what he had said. Even without ever having walked the road to Santiago, he knew what it was to fight the good fight. I found Petrus hiding behind some trees, obviously uncomfortable with the presence of the television cameras. It was only after their lights had been turned off that he emerged from the trees and relaxed a bit. We asked for two more cups of wine. I fixed myself a plate of canapés, and Petrus found a table where we could sit with some of the guests. The newlyweds cut into a huge wedding cake. People cheered. "They must really love each other."
"Of course they do," said a dark-suited man sitting with us. "Have you ever heard of anyone marrying for any other reason?"
I kept my answer to myself, remembering what Petrus had said about the popcorn vendor, but my guide didn't let it pass.
"Which kind of love are you talking about? Eros? Philos? Or agape?"
The man looked at him blankly. Petrus got up, filled his cup, and asked me to walk with him.
"There are three Greek words that mean love," he began. "Today you are seeing a manifestation of eros, the feeling of love that exists between two people."
The bride and groom were smiling for the photographers and accepting congratulations.
"It appears that these two really do love each other," he said, looking at the couple, "and they believe that their love would grow. But shortly they will be alone with each other, struggling to earn a living, build a house, and share their adventure. This is what ennobles love and dignifies it.
He will do his time in the army. She is probably a good cook and will be an excellent housewife, because she has been trained since she was a child for that role. She will be good company for him. They'll have children, and they will feel that they are building something together. They'll be fighting the good fight. So even if they have problems, they will never be really unhappy. However, this story that I am telling you could go a very different way. He might begin to feel that he's not free enough to express all of the eros, all of the love that he has for other women. She might begin to feel that she gave up a brilliant career in order to be with her husband. So instead of creating something together, each could begin to feel robbed of a means of expressing love. Eros, the spirit that unites them, would begin to reveal only its negative side. And what God had provided to humans as their noblest sentiment would become a source of hatred and destructiveness. I looked around me. Eros was present in many of the relationships there. The water exercise had awakened the language of my heart, and I was seeing people in a different way. Maybe it was the days of solitude on the road, or maybe it was the ram practices, but I could feel the presence of good Eros and evil Eros, just as Petrus had described. "It's strange," Petrus said, sensing the same thing. "Whether it's good or evil, the face of Eros is never the same for any two people. Just like the stars I was talking about a half hour ago. And no one can escape Eros. Everyone needs its presence, despite the fact that many times Eros makes us feel apart from the world, trapped in our own solitude." The band began to play a waltz. The guests went to a small cement section in front of the bandstand and started to dance. The alcohol was making itself felt, and people were perspiring more and smiling more. I noticed a girl dressed in blue who looked as if she had waited for this wedding just to have the chance to dance the waltz. She wanted to dance with someone who would embrace her in the way she had dreamed of since adolescence. She was watching a well-dressed boy who wore a white suit and stood among his friends. They were all talking and had not noticed that the waltz had begun. Nor did they see that a few yards away, a girl in a blue dress looked longingly at one of them. I thought about small towns and marriage to the boy one has dreamed of since childhood. The girl in blue saw that I was watching her and tried to conceal herself among her girlfriends. As she did, the boy searched for her with his eyes. When he saw that she was there with her friends, he went back to his conversation with his own group. I pointed out the two of them to Petrus. He watched the game of glances for a while, and then went back to his cup of wine. "They act as if it were shameful to make any show of love," was all he said. A girl near us was staring at Petrus and me. She must have been half our age. Petrus held up his cup of wine and made a toast in her direction. The girl laughed in embarrassment and pointed toward her parents as if to explain why she did not come closer. "That's the beautiful sight of love," Petrus said. "The love that dares. The love for two older strangers who have come from nowhere and will be gone tomorrow. Gone into a world where she would like to travel to." I could hear in his voice that the wine was having an effect on him. "Today we will talk of love," said my guide a bit loudly. "Let us speak of true love, which grows and grows, and makes the world go round and makes people wise." A well-dressed woman near us seemed not to be paying any attention at all to the party. She went from table to table, straightening the cups, the china, and the silverware. "See that woman there?" asked Petrus, "the one who's straightening things up. Well, as I said, Eros has many faces, and that's another of them. That's frustrated love, with its own kind of unhappiness. She's going to kiss the bride and groom, but inside she'll be saying that a knot has been tied around them. She's trying to neaten up the world, because she herself is in complete disorder. And there," he pointed toward another couple, the wife wearing excessive makeup and an elaborate coiffure, is eros accepted. Social love, without a vestige of passion. She has accepted her role and has severed any connection with the world or with the good fight.
You're being very bitter, Petrus. Isn't there anyone here who can be saved?
Of course there is. The girl who was watching us. The adolescents that are dancing, they know only about good eros. If they don't allow themselves to be influenced by the hypocrisy of the love that dominated the past generation, the world will certainly be a different place.
He pointed to an elderly couple sitting at one of the tables. And those two, also.
They haven't let themselves be infected by hypocrisy like the others. They look like working people. Hunger and need have required them to work together.
They learned the practices you are learning without ever having heard of Ram. They find the power of love in the work they do.
It's there that Eros shows its most beautiful face, because it's united with that of Philos.
What is Philos?
Philos is love in the form of friendship. It's what I feel toward you and others. When the flame of Eros stops burning, it is Philos that keeps a couple together.
And agape?
Today is not the day to talk about agape. Agape is in both Eros and Philos. But that's just a phrase. Let's enjoy the rest of the party without talking about the love that consumes.
And Petrus poured some more wine into his plastic cup. The happiness around us was contagious. Petrus was getting drunk. And at first I was a little surprised. But I remembered what he had said one afternoon, that the Ram practices made sense only if they could be performed by the common people. That night, Petrus seemed to be a person like any other. He was companionable and friendly, patting people on the back and talking to anyone who paid him any attention. A little later, he was so drunk that I had to help him back to the hotel. On the way, I took stock of my situation. Here I was, guiding my guide. I realized that at no time during the entire journey had Petrus made any effort to appear wiser, holier, or in any way better than I. All he had done was to transmit to me his experience with the Ram practices. Beyond that, he had made a point of showing that he was just like anyone else, that he experienced Eros, Philos, and Agape. This realization made me feel stronger. Petrus was just another pilgrim on the road to Santiago.
Enthusiasm. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and though I have the gift of prophecy, and have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not love, I am nothing.
Petrus was once again quoting from St. Paul. My guide felt that the Apostle Paul was the major occult interpreter of Christ's message. We were fishing that afternoon after having walked for the whole morning. No fish had yet perished on the hook, but Petrus didn't care about that at all. According to him, fishing was basically a symbol of the human being's relationship with the world. We know why we are fishing, and we will catch something if we stay with it. But whether we do or not depends on God's help.
It's a good idea always to do something relaxing prior to making an important decision in your life, he said. The Zen monks listen to rocks growing. I prefer fishing.
But at that time of day, because of the heat, even the fat, lazy fish on the bottom ignored the hook. Whether the bait was up or down, the result was the same. I decided to give it up and take a walk through the nearby woods. I went as far as an old abandoned cemetery close to the river. It had a gate that was totally disproportionate to the size of the burial ground, and then came back to where Petrus was fishing. I asked about the cemetery. The gate was part of an ancient hospital for pilgrims, he said, but the hospital was abandoned, and later someone had the idea of using the facade in building the cemetery, which has also been abandoned.
That's right. The things of this life don't last very long.
I said that he had been nasty the night before in his judgments of the people at the party, and he was surprised at me.
He said that what we had talked about was no more or less than we had ourselves experienced in our personal lives. All of us seek Eros, and then when Eros wants to turn itself into Philos, we think that love is worthless. We don't see that it is Philos that leads us to the highest form of love, agape. Tell me more about agape, I said. Petrus answered that agape cannot really be discussed. It has to be lived. That afternoon,